Hi, my name is Taylor. I'm an alcoholic and addict. Oh, yeah, there's the microphone. Okay, all right, it's hot in here. So, my sobriety date is 11/17/14, and for that, I'm truly grateful. This time of year, it was very hard for me 5 years ago because I'm an NA24 baby. I love you guys. I'm also Austin Recovery alumni. And if those two places didn't exist, I don't think that I would be here. Thank you so much. That was so kind and nice. Okay, so this time of year is like the hardest time of the year for me because I was in the shelter for Thanksgiving and I was in treatment for Christmas. And that was like really hard for me to be away from my family, my friends, mainly my kids. And had I not stayed in treatment throughout Christmas, I don't know where I would be. So I'm honored to be here with you guys that are in treatment. If I say anything that can help you, that's great. If I make you mad, do some writing on it, see what you can look at. I'm going to do something that Austin Recovery taught me when I was in treatment. I'm going to get in my little hula hoop. It sparkles and shines and shoots fire. Because what you think of me is none of my business. And telling my story, I have to open a few doors that I've had closed my entire life that I was afraid of what people would think about me. So a little bit about what it was like and who I was. Like she said, I was a gangbanger at one point. At least I thought it was. People were scared of me like I was a gangbanger. So I'm going to give you a little base foundation of what my childhood was like. The things I say, I'm not telling them to you so you feel sorry for me or to, you know, anything other than what they are, you know. Had those things not happened, I wouldn't be here today, okay? My childhood was not easy. It was extremely dysfunctional. In our child pictures, there were hanging pot plants in the back. Me and my sister would be, like, all posing with our teddy bears and our stuffed animals and our little 90s, thinking that we're taking family photos. But it was really the stash in the back, right? And I didn't notice that until I got older. Smoking pot was very acceptable in my family. When we were going to school, all we were told was what happens at home stays at home. You know, you can go to DARE, just don't tell on us. If you tell on us, we won't have us anymore. Okay, so that was like, you know, that's what it was like. Growing up in Dallas, I lived in every little city that there was. Hearst, Euless, Bedford, Carrollton, Richland. I can think of like 10 other ones. If you could look up the list of places that I've lived, even my parents, it's just like the list is just long. I looked it up one time. We moved around a lot, and I thought it was because we got new things and my parents, you know, had a lot of money. Really, we couldn't afford to pay the rent, and we had to move somewhere else. My parents ended up splitting, and my dad did everything that I thought he could to take care of us. He taught me how to steal from the grocery store. Anybody ever go grazing? You know, that's like, we're going to go graze. You're going to eat dinner. And he wore a big trench coat, and he'd, like, put all the meat in his. And I'd be like, you're so cool, Dad. I'll do that, too. Stuff into my pants, and we'd have dinner. You know, I did all the food pantries, you know, worked the system, the government. You know, I knew all those little church resources and stuff like that. Eventually, we ended up living on couches with my dad's friends and trying to go to school. And me and my sister finally went to my dad, and we were like, we just want to go to the same school. You know, we want to live with friends. You know, and we did. I lived with my sister and her boyfriend for a little while. That didn't work out too well. He was violent. So I decided to live with another friend of mine, and I was a bad influence on her. She was in eighth grade. I was in sixth grade. And we got caught with pot, and I would drink and pass out in my own vomit a lot. And she's like, her mom was like, make you dependent on my taxes and I get a refund, you need to find somewhere to go. Yeah, I know. She can't claim me, so. My father had gotten really sick, and we went to go see him in the hospital, and he had tubes in him and everything. He had a heart attack. And my mother came from Austin and got me and my sister. And we had already gotten the taste of doing what we want, going where we want, not having a nighttime, you know, all of those things, not doing homework. We were just trying to go to school. When I would stay at friends' houses, they had, like, dinner at the table with an extra fork. I know what that was like. I didn't know what it was. I didn't want to ask what that extra fork was. You know, they had normalcy, and I really liked that, you know. And when I went to go live with my mom, we were mad because she had to take care of us. So we were not giving her the best of time. You want us to do what? No, I'm going to come home 2 hours later. I'm going to stay out 2 more days. I'm going to run away for a month. You know, we did not give her the easiest path. I got to give her that. However, when bad things happened to me, the only way my mom could bond with me was to smoke a joint with me. She's like, that really happened? Here you go. And, you know, it just became acceptable. And I ended up, you know, I'm always in the same spot everywhere I go. It doesn't matter what age I'm at. I'm always in the middle of everything. I'm the drug dealer. And always have a boyfriend. That's the drug dealer. Or not. No, they were all drug dealers. And that was my life. I was always attracted to the high life, the style, the parties, the, you know, I was still trying to go to school and just wasn't normal, you know. I think living here in Austin, I really liked it, but I didn't really want to be here. My mom was always discrediting me to the stepdad. We'd get caught with weed and she would give us our paraphernalia back and smoke our weed in front of us. Because my stepdad was like, that's not okay. You know, so I always lived this underlying fake friendship with my mom. My mom came in one day and told me that she was going to move away and meet somebody on the internet and marry them. And I'm like, oh my God, I don't have a pot to piss in. So I had to go live with my boyfriend, who was 21 and I was 15. So not only was he 21 and my boyfriend, but now he just became my dad and my brother because I had to live with him and I had to ask permission. Like, can I go out? I just made you $2,000. Can I go out and hang out with my friends? It was retarded. That didn't last too long. But I got in a lot of trouble in Austin. I got caught with a whole bunch of drugs. Surprise, surprise. And I got asked to leave the state of Texas. Now, the only reason why I got asked to leave the state of Texas is because I didn't live with either one of my parents. I used to make a really bad joke about that, but I don't have to do that today. So instead of picking Illinois, where I would end up on Jerry Springer, I picked Oklahoma. So I lived in Oklahoma for 10 years. Nothing changed. They said that I needed to get my NA card signed. I went to go live with my dad. My dad learned how to walk and talk again. He had a few heart attacks and a few strokes. And I, you know, he co-signed my BS. We fake signed the card, came back to Austin, showed up to court one day, and they're like, oh, you're going to NA meetings. I'm like, sure. Sure, I'm going. And I wasn't going. So that charge was dismissed, and I just stayed in Oklahoma. And I got in the same trouble I got in here. I was in the same different kind of relationships up there. I was still running things, you know, selling drugs in the middle of everything. Everybody skipped school to come over to my house to watch Jerry Springer back when that was on. So I'm 38. You can kind of tell that was a while back. Nothing changed. Nothing changed. My dad got really sick. He got 14 mini strokes. And then he had dementia. And I was 17. And I didn't really like going to school anyways, so I quit school, and I took care of my dad. And that was very difficult for me, but I always took on a lot. I was always taking care of somebody else. And I was still selling drugs. I was still trying to be in a relationship. I was taking care of my dad. I was taking care of all his appointments. I got him on Social Security. I got him on disability. Like, I was so good at doing things for everybody else. And the whole time, I'm hoping that he remembers me. I'm getting drunk. I'm getting high. And I'm waiting for that moment that he remembers who I am. On top of that, I still want to live the lifestyle. So I don't know about you guys, but when I got drunk, I got naked. Right? I just did. And it was just a nice, good idea that if you're going to get drunk and you're going to get loud and you're going to get naked, you might as well go get paid for it. And so I was like, score! Yes! Because in those moments, you know, I could get paid, I could have fun, I could party, and I could have control over what people did or didn't do to me. Like, you can't touch me. And I loved that validation. And I had a daughter at that time, too, also taking care of my dad. Just got rid of the ex-husband, so it's like, rah, so I'm just party. I did everything that a 21-year-old would do before the age of 14. Like, downtown 6th Street wasn't shit to me. I'd already done all that. I'd hang out. All my friends were over 21. You know, I'd already done the downtown scene. I'm done with that. So it's like, when I started taking care of my dad, I was already done with all of that, you know? So I was like a homebody. So when my daughter was asleep, my dad was asleep, I'd go party. I didn't find much time to sleep. That lifestyle was okay for about 6 years. The seventh year, I went downhill. I got on meth, a lot of meth. I started doing the hotel meth thing. I don't know if you guys know about all that.
Yeah.
Sit up in a hotel room. I remember when I used to sit outside in the parking lot of hotels, and in 30 minutes, you can tell who's on it. It's like whack-a-mole. I can go to that room right there and get high. All I got to do is knock on the door, as long as they're not that paranoid. Do you know? I got involved in some really, really, really bad things in Oklahoma. Really, really, really bad things. And I decided that I was going to stop doing that stuff. I had lost my dad. APS took him away because I wasn't taking care of him. I didn't have the ability. I was so selfish that I just wanted him. And I made promises I couldn't keep, that I would be able to take care of him and not have him die alone. And that broke my heart. So I have this little girl, and I'm mad, and I'm ashamed, and I'm angry, and I go take her to my sister, like I usually do, and I drop her off, and I go do whatever I want. I'm like, she'll be fine. You know, it was my time to live, because God forbid, I just spent all this time taking care of him. Now I got accused of doing all these other things. Like, I'm just going to go live, and I would just drop her off. I drop my daughter off a lot. Like, when I used to get made up and go out, my daughter used to be, like, the whole time, she would be screaming and crying and tears holding onto my leg, like, because she didn't know when I was going to come back. I would leave, and I'd be like, I'll be back tomorrow. I'll be back at midnight, or 3 or 4 in the morning, whatever that looks like. And I was that mom that, like, instilled that fear into my daughter. And she just didn't know when I was going to come home. And I didn't think that when I had her that I was ever going to hurt her. You know, I had her and I was like, I'm not going to have her go through anything that I went through. I'm going to be there for her. I'm going to be nice to her. And I'm not going to let her go through things I went through. And that was a lie. And after I got off the charges I got in Oklahoma, which there's a few. And one of my horrible dope stories is, you know, I got arrested with some dope. I woke up in jail. I thought I was in jail because I was arrested for stealing a car, which wasn't the case. I missed my arraignment because they lost me in jail. That's weird, right? 5 days later, I get out at 10 o'clock on July 4th, and I don't even know where my daughter is. I dropped her off at a friend's house before I was going to work, and I didn't even go look for her. I went to the dope house. Of course, I drove by 3 or 4 houses just in case cops were following me and stopped there real quick and then go to another house. And then I went to the real dope house. And I'm trying to figure out how to get the guy that didn't take the charge out of jail, knowing that I had a kid somewhere, that I just, you know, it's a mad hatter. If you're in a car with somebody and you have drugs and nobody claims it, you all go to jail. And I'd go try and figure out how to get him out and get high first. That's what I do. And so I pick up my daughter eventually, and it's just the same thing. Like, I would drop her off over there and go do whatever, say I'm going to get my stuff together. I don't. I show up on a Sunday. I miss her birthday. I don't ever talk about this one. I was trying to make as much money as possible that weekend just for fun to beat the other dope dealer, because that's what I do. And I beat him, but I miss my daughter's birthday. And I keep on telling her I'm going to be there, and I don't show up. And then after I realize, like, I can't show up this high, right, and they already sang her happy birthday. So I'm going to rob this dope dealer because I can't do meth. So I'm going to take all his coke, and I'm going to get off meth by doing coke. I show up the next day to get my daughter, and they call the police. And that cop comes out tired, and he tells me how much of a horrible mother I am, and there's nothing he can do about it, but he's going to give me my daughter. And I take her, and I'm not even listening. I just grab her and the cake. She's 3. She doesn't even know I missed her birthday. They reminded her, you know. And I take her, and I don't talk to my family. I get back in the old relationship with the ex, and then I get a job at Home Depot, and then after that doesn't work out, I moved back here to Austin. And I'm, you know, change places, people, things. I move back to Austin, and of course I get in another relationship. Nothing changes. And I have a son. So I'm still getting blackout drunk. I have this beautiful life with a house, a car, a new relationship, new baby. I'm drinking a bottle of vodka every night to go to sleep. Because I feel bad that I'm happy my dad's alone in a home. That's my truth. And I'm acting like everything's okay and I'm not dealing with it. So I drink. I do meth. And then I start shooting meth, but I got to do meth with the people that are smoking it because I'm high and shooting it. And that's just a bitch. You know? It is. It's hard to hide that. And then that relationship doesn't work out, right? So the basis of all these stories is that once it becomes just me, my daughter, and my son, just us, I still do the same things, except it gets worse. I'm starting to do heroin. I'm popping all these pills. I'm drinking alcohol. I have random people in the house. My daughter even called somebody the milkman. Look, it's the milkman, Mom. She's like 10 or 11 at this point, calling me on my stuff. Now I get in this one relationship. And my daughter has seen things that she doesn't need, should have never seen. She's been places she never should have been. And however, if there was a kitten or a dog or YouTube or a computer, my kids were great, you know. But they saw things that they didn't need to see. My son used to slap me around and wake me up thinking that I was dead. And sometimes when my kids didn't listen to me, I knew that they would act different if I was sick or if they thought I was dying. So I manipulated my kids. And I would lie and pretend like I wasn't well so they would just shut up and listen or do what I said or go get me something or just be quiet. You know, there came a time where I just didn't know how to respond to my kids. They had opinions. They were old enough. They weren't just going to get in the car anymore. I had to, like, convince them and bribe them and lie to them. Like, yeah, we're going to go here, but we didn't go there, you know. My daughter took on a lot, and she's seen a lot of things. She saw... okay, so there was one night that... other than my daughter always having to call an ambulance to come get my naked ass off the floor because I was so sick and I couldn't get up or I was overdosing or some reason, and I would always end up in the hospital. And then the family would show up and they would take my kids, and I would, this one time I actually gave them all the passwords to my Facebook and my Google. Like, you know, you like, I'm totally think I'm dying, and if you're paranoid like me and you give them all your passwords, like, it's done. And they just looked at me like, when are you going to change? So there was a guy that I was with, and my daughter watched him bash my face against the table. And we'd gotten a lot of other pushing arguments before that. So I was bleeding from a lot of different places. And I was left in a pool of blood. And my daughter saw this. And I didn't get up and call the police. I didn't call an ambulance. I didn't call for help. I went and found my keys in the yard. I got in my car. I drove across town and went to the dope house. And I walk up like Carrie. And I'm looking at everybody, and they're like, oh, my God. And I'm like, I just want to get high. And you can see the look on their face. I think it's funny now because the look on their face is where, if we did, where's it going to go? It's just going to come out of you. You know, they're like, we don't know if we should share. And I just wanted to get high. That was my truth. I just didn't want to deal with anything. I didn't want to face anything. I didn't want to, like, I was so ashamed. Like, the people that I chose, the people that I loved, they were, like, beating me and abandoning me. And then I have to turn and look at my daughter, and I don't have an explanation for these things. And there was a day that my daughter came to me, and she had told me that I needed to change, but she came at me cross, like she was ready to fight. She's 11, my height, and wanted to fight. But before this, she wanted to go live with friends. Like, she was ready to go, because the electricity was off, the gas was off, the water was off. They were going over to friends' houses and taking showers. They were eating friends for dinner, you know, like they weren't at home a lot. They didn't want to be there. Like, there was nothing much to be there for. I was so out of it. I was so out there. And there was another time that before actually it was after my face got beaten. I like getting tattoos. Every time I'd get child support, I'd go get a tattoo. And I took my kids with me to South First and Altorf to get a tattoo, and they had to be in the waiting room because it was in a place that they didn't need to be in the room. And I decided to pop two Xanaxes and take a 24-ounce. And I blacked out. I woke up in Kyle, Texas. I didn't know how I got there. I didn't ask how I got there. I woke up, put my kids in the car, didn't ask how they were, just put them in the car. And there was a backpack full of stolen goods. Apparently, I robbed the place. I show up, and I ask the guy, why didn't you finish my tattoo? And he goes, in the 16 years I've been doing tattoos, this has never happened. He says, you beat me up. He's 230-pound Mexican. Hispanic, sorry. And I gave him the backpack. He says, apparently you robbed me. And he says, I can't tattoo you until you're sober. I can't deal with you. And I was like, really? Because I got the script. And he's like, okay, I'll finish you up. You know, and he had told me that when I'd left, I'd walked down the stairs and I'd passed out in front of my car, and both my kids thought I was dead. And I'm on South First Nortorf. Like, I don't even have the thought process to think about the future of how me and my kids are going to get home. And I don't even care to ask them how they are the next day. You know, so when my daughter told me that I needed to change, I was angry. I was mad because she was right. And I proceeded to tongue lash her and like tell her, I'm your mother. We're just going to move and we're going to change schools and we're going to change your friends. And, you know, I'm like mad at her. So I'm verbally like going to take all these things she loves away verbally. So I take her to my sisters. I tell them all I'm going to get my stuff together. And I don't. I'm 3 days late picking them up. And when I show up, I'm high. And they call the police on me again. And the police officer comes out and says, hey, I'm not going to put this 13-year-old daughter, this 12-year-old, 11 or 12, I forgot exactly how old she was, in your car. She's scared of you. And I'm like, hi. I'm like, I got paperwork. I got full rights. She's getting in my car. You better put her ass in my car. So I call the cops. I call my own cop. Because I'm high. And I can't, you know, and the other cop comes up. He goes, I agree with this guy. We're not putting her in your car. Like, I'm surprised I didn't go to jail for public intoxication because I was loaded. And so I'm like, fine, I'm going to go get my son. So I go over to my son's father's house and I go pick him up. And he's like, if you can pass a drug test, I'll give you your son. And I'm like, please don't do this to me right now. You know, please don't do this. We used to get high together. Please don't do this to me right now. And he's like, better yet, if you can get your daughter alone in a room with you, I'll let you see your son. And I was fucked. Like, if my daughter's just like me, she's completely opposite. I mean, when it comes to, she's stubborn. Like, there's no way. I knew there was no way she was ever going to be alone in a room with me. I knew what I'd done to her. I knew what I'd said to her. I knew how many times I'd let her down. All the promises that I made. I knew how bad I hurt her. And if she's anything like me, this is never going to happen. So, yeah. That's how bad it was. I chose drugs and alcohol and my pride over my children. And men. So when I got sober, finally decided to get sober, it was the hardest decision I ever had to make. And I only did it because I knew CPS was going to, like, I had to do a checklist for CPS. I didn't really do it for, you know, me. I did it because of CPS. And I made a phone call to somebody I didn't know who just so happened to be president of the alumni of Austin Recovery. When I came to Austin Recovery, I thought I had like a referral in the system because I told the judge that I was going to go to treatment and they needed to refer me into treatment. And so I thought that I had like this referral in the commuter system. And when I walked in there, they're just going to take me. And that was not the case. I had a few front teeth and a big head, a mohawk. I know. Gifted. I did. Poor head. I was wearing snow pants. You could like hear me coming a mile away. I probably sat in every single one of these seats because I couldn't stay still. I remember. And when I came here, they sent me to North Austin 24. And I hit my knees in the parking lot, and all I wanted to do was stay sober. And it was scary to walk into a room full of happy people that were drinking alcohol, talking about all the stuff they had lost, and they were happy, and then they were sober, and they had all this time, and then they had their families back, and they're just working, God, God, God. I'm like, oh my God, I'm in a cult. We're talking about God. All I had to do was just sit there and listen and do what they told me to do. I learned how to make my bed, not leave anything out, because they will lock you out if you leave something on the counter. If you don't do your chores. I didn't know what that, I remember standing out there like, who did what? Like, there's some certain rules that you, I mean, they teach you to protect your stuff, put your stuff up, you know, make your bed, and go to these meetings. And I remember I finally was able to come here. And what's so beautiful about tonight is that I came here tomorrow, 5 years ago. Yeah. So this is like my heart's all fuzzy because I actually, like, I was here tomorrow, 5 years ago. And nowhere better to put it. I'm an addict. I don't care. So I came in this place, and everybody was really, I mean, minus the clients. The staff was, like, amazing, you know? They were beefing you up, you know, like, you can do this, you know, everything's going to be all right. All you got to do is be honest and, you know, tell the truth, do some work, you know, show up for this, show up for that. And I'm like, okay. I mean, the women were nuts. I met Tommy here. When I met Tommy here, like, I've got the best friendships out of this program. the alumni would come out and they would talk, and I wanted to be like them. They were all fresh, shiny, and new, and they were like crackheads and, you know, dope heads, and you know, they had new teeth too, and they didn't have to be there, and they were there, and they had all these crazy stories. I'm like, me too, I've done that, I've done that, I've done that, I've done that. But I didn't want to talk about it, you know. And when I met Tommy, I was sitting on a bench, and, you know, I had a few front teeth and big Ted, like, big Ted, Mohawk, crazy. Of course, I got a lot of tattoos. And I'm like, I don't think you want to sit next to me. She's like, I don't give a fuck. And I'm like, well, we can sit here and not give a fuck together. And she has this big old fur coat. I'll never forget it. I want to get her a fur coat. It's beautiful. And we've had this journey together. So when things happen, I like call her. You know, like I was at her house for a few hours a day, just sitting there, you know. And when things happen, I call people in the program. I call anybody, an alumni. So when I got here, step one, I had to admit that I was completely, I was fucked. Every way that I tried to get sober, deal with my problems, or my life, it failed. My pride will tell me, I'm okay, I'm good, I'll figure it out. My entire life, I'm okay, I'm good, I'll figure it out. Because I'm alone. Like I'm in a room full of people, and I'm alone. Because if I told you the things that I'd done and I'd thought about, you would judge me and you wouldn't like me and I'd be like torn goods. You know, you wouldn't understand. There's no way you'd understand anything I've been through. No way. You have no idea the things that I've done and I've been through. We couldn't relate. We'd be like one up in each other on stories and stuff. And number two, all I had to do was believe that it worked in somebody else. And I'd seen that in the alumni when they'd come out and they'd talk, you know. And my third step, I love my first sponsor. She's here this evening. Thank God. I just borrowed her God. Like, I had to get a sponsor. When they told you to get a sponsor, go to meetings. Everything you put in front of your recovery, you're going to lose. Write that bitch a note. You might as well say bye to it. Because everything you put in front of your sobriety, you're going to lose anyways. Sobriety comes first, period. I put it in front of everything. I even try to manipulate that. I got to go to a meeting. I can't be home on time. They're like, you could have gone to a meeting earlier. I'm like, damn it. So I borrowed my sponsor's God for the first, you know, year, and this, and the fellowship and the alumni and the meetings were my higher power. And the things that I had to talk about in my fifth and fourth step, you know, were the things that, and I always encourage everybody, please talk about the things you want to take to your grave. That's it. All you have to do is talk about it. And sometimes how you feel and what you think are the things you don't want anybody to know. You want to take that to your grave. Fuck her, I hate her, I don't like this. When I did my fifth step, I thought, awesome, I'm going to have this list of people that are going to come and tell me they're sorry. I'm like, I want to know how this is going to work, because I got a long list of people that need to come and tell me they're sorry. I just could not wait. Yes, 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 yes. And we sat out there and we started talking, and then some other stuff came up, you know. And I actually did a fifth step with a therapist and my sponsor, because there's just some things that I needed consistent help with, you know. For example, before the age of 15, I was sexually assaulted, abused, or molested by 13 different people. That's a lot to take on. On top of that, not being able to trust mom, dad, sister, aunts. They're abandoning me. They're leaving me. They're just, you know, or, you know, they're doing the best that they could, right? And here I am. I'm trying to be something that I'm not, because I gotta fucking survive. Live wherever. My will is strong, but it's killing me. Like, I couldn't be that child that I was supposed to be, that could have been, right? Like, I'm always constantly, I have this Kevlar skin. It's, you can't, like, I'll let you around me, I'll hang out with you, I'll party with it, but you ain't getting in. And if you walk up to the biggest, baddest dude, just knock him out, people will leave you alone. And that's what I did sometimes. I'm not recommending it. Not proud of it. My son actually saw me do it to his dad, and I vowed not to ever fight again. Like, which made the guy that knocked my teeth out, like, I wasn't going to fight him back. Like, I made this promise, and it hurt, and it's a big mess, right? But I won't fight anymore. I can't. You know, it just hurts people. Like, I cannot hurt anybody today. Those are never going to be my intentions in life. And so, by doing all this work and writing all this stuff out and having all these realizations, you know, I found out that I was neglected as a kid. And I didn't want everyone to admit that. You know, I had harmed my children. I never want to admit that. I didn't know how to be a mom. I didn't have any examples. I don't know, integrity, morals, stability, structure. I didn't want to ask anybody else, hey, how do you be a mom? What does your evenings look like? Because I would rather drink, party as soon as I go to bed. Like, I know how to make a lunch and put them, go to school. But I didn't know how to be comforting. I didn't know how to be a friend. I'd done inappropriate things with all my friends. I didn't know how to be there for somebody. I knew how to coast on their bullshit. And this program has taught me how not to do those things. But I had to forgive myself first. Oh, you know, just being here and somebody telling me, you need to forgive yourself. And I'm like, I was holding on to all those things and I was using all those things to manipulate all those people. So that way I didn't have, you know, like, I didn't know what that looked like. I had to forgive myself. What's very important about this story is that I've told you a story about me as a little girl and my daughter as a little girl. The story of the two little girls is that I finally got to 6 and 7. I wanted to beat my sponsor's ass for telling me something was wrong with me. Like, I got to change some more, right? Is that I was the common denominator in all my problems. After all the things I've been through, you're not going to tell me. I thought she was going to tell me, it's okay, you can go drink some, girl. You go drink some more. No. You know, I got all that stuff off my chest. I got to open up to another human being. I got to feel free. I got to admit to another woman that I didn't know how to be a lady. And all I wanted to do was be a woman. Because I've been so rough and tough all my life. And there's no way I was going to let you in. You know. And my pride and my ego is, I'm my own worst enemy. I'll look at myself in the mirror and be like, you're not good enough. You're not tall enough. You're not smart enough. You're not just enough. You know, if you'd have done this, he wouldn't have done that. Instead of going, they probably shouldn't have been in your life anyways. You know, I was my own worst enemy. I'm not skinny enough. I'm not fat enough. This ain't big enough. They say, whatever. You're just not pretty enough. Maybe they would have. Maybe they wouldn't have done that to you. Maybe they wouldn't have cheated on you and left you. It's like, I'm my own worst enemy. I've heard this story once where a guy calls another guy and he's like, hey man, what are you doing? He's like, I'm just chilling at the house. He goes, are you by yourself? And he's like, yeah. And he's like, get out of the house. You're alone with a killer. Better go to a meeting. Because, you know, I will tear myself down and I will figure out a way to just, no, not today. So what I do today, when it comes to 8, 9, and 10, I do pray. I do still do amends. The living amends is the most important part to me. When I was in treatment, somebody told me the one thing that you can offer your family is to just be sober. I had nothing. I didn't have pot to pizza. Somebody gave me cigarettes before I got into treatment. It's like the only gifts that you have to give to your family this year is your sobriety. It's the best thing in the world. Nobody can take that from you. And that's the only thing that I can give. And that is a powerful gift. It's just to give, like, I'm sober. And I'll be here on Christmas Day, you know. I'll tell you what, when I got out of treatment, I got out on New Year's Eve. The worst day to get out of treatment. I took my meds and I went to bed. And I made it to another day. I did everything that was suggested. You go to sober living a year. Always call your sponsor. Do your nightly. Sober living, I did not like it, but I tell you what, I appreciate my apartment today. I do. I love my apartment. I like to sleep in my bed unless it's maybe Tommy's. Sleep in Tommy's bed. The one thing I really like to go ahead and let y'all know is that when I did the steps, again, another way of looking at it is if you don't like the steps, I get it, right? But if you look at it in this way, and this is what I had to do because I still have this little picture of myself when I was a kid. Like a baby, kind of. I had bangs. I have bangs now, but whatever. I get to take those moments that I felt broken, torn, abused, neglected, spiritually, just like, I don't know if you ever had walked into church and they're like, eat of my flesh, drink of my blood, or you'll have no life in you. I'm like, these are cannibals. I'm out. Right? I was freaked out about the whole God thing. And if there was a God, then all these things wouldn't have happened to me. I hated it. I get to go back 5 minutes before all of that with these steps, and I get to grab that child by the arm that I've been trying to protect my whole life, that I'm really not protecting, I'm hurting, and I'm not letting breathe. And I get to go back and I'd be like, come on, there's a new way that we can live now. And I no longer talk to myself like I would like someone I don't like. I talk to myself like I would a child. Like, hey, I know this hurts right now, but you know, we can't rock that orange jumpsuit today. You know, this is what we're going to do. Like, I love you. You're beautiful. You're worth it. You're amazing. You can get through this. We can do this. All we have to do is pick up that phone. It's a heavy fucking phone, but we're going to pick it up. And we're going to call somebody. We're going to go to a meeting. We're going to go help somebody else. Feed the homeless. I don't care what it is. Go get a bag of burgers and go, you know, do something. Call somebody for some coffee that lives down the street. Antoinette, can I get a hug? You know, when things are going wrong in my life, I have these tools that I use, and they're nothing like the ones I used to. Because I used to like to drink, get naked, shoot dope, and wake up next to I don't know who. And I don't have to do that today. You know what I mean? So the story about my daughter. My daughter decided that she wanted to live with me again. Yeah. It only took like 18 months. I got the apartment anyways, even though I didn't know if I was ever going to see my kids again. I got that two-bedroom apartment just in case. And she did. She came to live with me, and now she's 17. I'm only going to spend a few more minutes on this, but I was in my house with Tommy, and my daughter's really good about dropping bombs on me. And she came in as a sophomore and told me that she got accepted into family law. As a junior, so she's like ahead of the game. She's really smart, makes really good grades. She's, you know, I have got to tell you, if you have a family member, especially if they're children, like, she took a lot for her. Because for me, like, I'm like, cool, easy way out. I'll go live with friends, deuces, parents. You know, she did what I couldn't do. And she came to me and she's like, you need to change and I deserve better. And that's what she had to do. And I, like, I'm so jealous, but I'm so, like, that took a lot. And so she took the situation, and she made it a better one. And I applaud her for that. She didn't quit school. She's still in school. She's above and succeeding. And she came in and dropped this picture of her acceptance letter in front of me and Tommy. And then she brings her laptop, and she goes, here, you can read the rough draft. And me, because I'm a proud mom, I emailed it to myself. And then like a month later, I'm like, can I read it? And she's like, that's fine, whatever, but it's a rough draft. I don't think she'll ever show me the final because it's pretty hard. So I'm going to read this for you guys, and I'm going to try not to cry. My name is Jordan. I'm applying for pre-law studies internship. Stephen Covey once said, find your voice and inspire others to find theirs. I want to be in this internship because I want to help others be able to fight for what is right. I want to help people find their voice and be able to stand up for themselves and others. I learned I wanted to do this since I was 11 years old. I went from playing with dolls and tag and having to make a decision that could predict my whole future. A mother should be a person that you can go to and call and be there when you're home, where your mother is with you, where you're safe and full of warmth. But unfortunately, I didn't get to experience that. Growing up, it was unhealthy for me to be around my mom. My mom is a drug addict and alcoholic, or she's been one since she was a teen. Because of this, it was unsafe for me to be there. She never realized that she needed to stop until I gained the courage to speak up about it. When I was younger, I wasn't afforded the opportunity to be a kid. I had to take care of myself since my mom had trouble doing so. And I didn't really have friends because I would jump from home to home. Soon enough, I was tired of it, and I was tired of feeling alone. I was tired of being my own parent. I was tired of not having a place to come home to. I just wanted my mom back. I wanted her clean. I wanted to feel safe and be happy with her. I couldn't keep pretending like everything was okay. I knew I had to find my voice, and I finally did. One day, I went to my aunt and uncle and asked to use the phone. I ended up calling the police and started a CPS case on my mother. I wouldn't be able to get back into her custody until she was sober. This case lasted until the start of my eighth grade year. That's when I got to move back in with her. This normally doesn't happen in other cases, where mothers and daughters get a good ending, and I really feel lucky that me and my mom did. My mother and I have our differences, but I'm glad now that currently she'll be 5 years sober this coming November on the 17th. Not only is she clean, but I have my mom back, and I'm glad to have someone that I can lean on. I feel like after speaking up and finding my voice, everything became possible again. I just want to help other people find their voice and to tell people that it's okay. This is why I want to be a part of the pre-law internship, to help me grow as a better person and to learn how to help fight for other people's happiness. Being in this internship will help me learn to fight for what is right, and maybe soon I could be helping kids like me in family court.
I love y'all.
Not done yet. I love my daughter. So what I would like to end this note on, or this meeting on, is that growing up, I didn't feel like I was somebody. I was always trying to be somebody I wasn't. I was always trying to be who somebody else wanted me or needed me to be. I never got the opportunity to get my own apartment, take care of myself, learn how to love myself. And this place and these rooms and these meetings and these steps taught me how to love myself. It's just an instruction of how I love myself and how I treat other people. And everybody in here is either a mother, a daughter, a sister, a brother, brother-in-law, grandpa, grandma. You are somebody to somebody. And if you don't think that you are somebody to me. And if nobody has told you they love you today, I do. However, there's something that every single one of you in here needs to know. You guys are all a ray of sunshine and hope. You guys all have the ability to help, if not thousands, one other person. If one other person is enough for me. You know, like, and if I used to be called the feral sister. I am now domesticated. However, like, I love every single one of you, and every single one of you, if you can, I'll challenge you to do one thing tonight. If you're, even if you're in treatment or not, go home, make your bed if it's not made, and I want you to open up the sheet, and then I want you to put your sweet-ass gift that you are in there and live in that present moment, and tomorrow, you get to unwrap yourself to be the gift that you fucking are, right? And if you don't know this, you know this now. You are my family. You guys are all my brothers and sisters in recovery. And if you ever need anything, we alumni will be there. Oh, yeah. Okay? I love you. Merry Christmas.